Welcome to the Water Resources Podcast. I am Bridget Scanlon. In this podcast, we discuss water challenges with leading experts, including topics on extreme climate events, overexploitation, and potential solutions towards more sustainable management. I'm delighted to welcome Augusto Gitarana to the podcast. Augusto is a research scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in the Hydrological Sciences Lab. And today, Augusto will be speaking in his own capacity and not representing NASA in the podcast. Augusto's research involves development, improvement, and application of state-of-the-art models and integration of remote sensing data. And today, I think we're going to focus on applications to global and regional flooding and the relatively new SWOT, Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite for Surface Water Monitoring globally, and improvements in NASA models and integrating with satellite data. And lastly, because Augusto is from Brazil, we'll talk a little bit about the Amazon, his work in the Amazon and floods and droughts, and the need for planning in Brazil. So thank you so much, Augusto, for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So Augusto, maybe let's start with your recent work on global floods in 2025. I thought that was a very interesting analysis and compilation of the flooding in the world in 2025. And you used EMDAT, I guess, Emergency Events Database, to evaluate flood fatalities and economic losses in that year from flooding. And I guess it wasn't really that high in 2025, 4,200 deaths related to flooding, which is still huge. And then an estimated $28 billion worth of damages. So maybe you can describe, you know, the analysis and the methodology you applied and the modeling analysis and the resolution of the analysis.
Yeah, that's a good start. So just to give some background to listeners, so we used a high map force with GLDAS runoff. So GLDAS is the popular global land data simulation system, and HiMap is the hydrological modeling analysis platform, which is a global hydrodynamic model developed at NASA Goddard's Hydrological Science Lab. And that is including the Land Information System, or LIS, which is a modeling framework also developed at Goddard. Back to the floods in 2025, based on these model outputs at 5 kilometer resolution, we observed that there is no clear increase in extreme flood events in the past 22 years. Actually, 2025 falls within the low tier, as you mentioned, in the number of rivers showing extreme flows when compared to the past two decades. And when you overlap the population data with these extreme flow maps from the model, we get to a similar conclusion in terms of people exposed to extreme river flows. This means that the exposed population is also in the low tier compared to the past two decades. But also, looking at the emergency events database, the EMDAT dataset, as you referred to, well, we also find that the last year falls within the low tier in numbers of deaths and damage resulting from floods. So that is aligned with the model outputs. And also looking at the annual time series of all these different variables, this means the model, the extreme flood events, observed deaths and damage, we don't see a particular trend. So these findings go against our general assumption that flood frequency and intensity have been increasing, which could be a matter of a general perception resulting from unlimited and instantaneous access to global information. But at the same time, even that disaster dataset has some limiting criteria to define that disaster to be entering that database, such as the number of that minimal number of deaths, minimal number of people affected, and a call for international assistance.
That's interesting. We're mostly hearing that everything is getting worse, and it's good. And I guess I was also looking at Aon Insurance, Reinsurance, their catalog of climate extremes, and very consistent with what you were finding. And they mentioned in the US, hurricane landfalls were low. And then they also mentioned severe convective storms being a big thing in the US. But so can you talk a little bit more about the major floods that occurred in 2025 in the different regions?
Yeah, so in 2025, we saw major floods across multiple regions, each driven by different mechanisms, but with severe human consequences. As mentioned, there were around 4,200 deaths last year, which is not the record. It's actually, as I said, it fell in the low tier. So first, in parts of Asia, mostly South and Southeastern Asia, floods killed over 1,000 people, largely from prolonged monsoon rainfalls that overwhelmed rivers and the infrastructure. There was the flood in Central Texas. There was a different dynamic. In that case, intense overnight rainfall over the steep terrain that triggered rapid flash flooding, and there was little warning time that also caused multiple deaths. And also, and then a different one that was in southern Brazil, heavy rainfalls hit soils that were already saturated after extreme flooding the previous year in 2024. That was an actual disaster. So then led to a repeated inundation. So basically, what 2025 showed us is that floods aren't just about extreme rain. They're about timing, land conditions, topography, and exposure. And climate influences the hazard, but vulnerability determines the severity of that impact.
Yeah, and that's a really nice description. And oftentimes we're looking at flood risk, and that includes hazard, the hazard from the flooding, and then the exposure and the vulnerability. And so it's interesting to think about the different factors that drive these major floods. And you mentioned monsoon, and then in Central Texas, you know, it was a holiday, July 4th, a lot of people unfamiliar with the area, and happened overnight, and all of these different factors that contributed to, you know, almost 140 people dying in that flood. And then the importance of antecedent soil moisture conditions in southern Brazil. When the soils are wet, there's no space for the water to go. And so then that increases your chances of flooding. So very interesting. And Augusto, you have done some very interesting work also at a city scale in Rio de Janeiro, where you're from, to evaluate flooding issues there and try to help the communities better manage floods. Maybe you can describe that for us.
Yeah, that's a very exciting work. It's this unique partnership between NASA and the municipality. It's the only one that NASA has ever had. It's been around for 10 years. We just renewed for 5 more years last December, when the goal of this partnership is to combine NASA assets with local knowledge and expertise to address urban hazards. So basically, you're applying our assets to the urban / local scale and try to make it transferable. So it's kind of a guinea pig for our capabilities. So in the framework of this partnership, we transfer landslide monitoring system for operations. So NASA has this global landslide monitoring system that was downscaled to the city of Rio. In the past years, we've been working on an urban flood monitoring system based on HiMap, 200-meter spatial resolution with a post-processing downscale to 10 meters. So this means that we can have flood maps at the building scale as a result. So that system is in the final step of operations. And once it's operational, the next step is hopefully extend to the system to a 1-2-day forecast. It's important to highlight here that such a partnership is only possible because of the strong engagement that both parts have. We had like monthly meetings for the past several years, constant email exchanges, workshops. They came here together. We've been there to train them how to use the NASA tools. And also, the local team is highly qualified. In our calls and in our interactions, we can't speak the same language when we're having technical discussions.
That's really wonderful. And maybe you can just provide a little bit of background to the listeners. Rio, you've got very steep topography. It's at the coast, and then you've got steep topography. And so you've got orographic effects. And what about the storm drainage system? Is it well developed or not? What part of the year do you see most of the flooding? And how can they better prepare to become more resilient to flooding?
Yeah, so Rio has been flooding. It's a historical problem. So basically every year between November and April, that's the rainy season, the summer, also summer and rainy season there when you have floods. And some of them were pretty major. In 2019, there was a flood. There were two floods in February and April that killed a few people and stopped the city. So I think it's the drainage system is not as maintained. I think there's an aspect of maintenance of the drainage system, and combined with probably under-dimensioned drainage system that's not prepared for those floods, since it happens every year. So in terms of better preparedness, I think having a system like this one that you're developing is the first step, because you don't have any information about floods until it happens. So once you have a system like this that you can also forecast 1-2 days ahead, you can have, okay, now we know, now we have information. So the baseline is you need data. So without data, you can't plan anything. So now with this work, I hope that they will have a better structure, better information to make better decisions.
Well, I mean, it will improve their understanding of the system. It's marvelous, Augusto, how your work ranges from global scale to urban scale, you know, and that you can bridge those gaps and downscale your models and everything to get to that more detailed level. That is really cool.
Yeah, it's a challenge.
Another aspect that's fundamental to your work is incorporating satellite data into your modeling. So you really integrate satellite and modeling. And NASA launched the Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite in December 2022, I think. And that is really advances your ability to monitor surface water globally in comparison with what we have used traditionally, which is altimetry. So would love to hear you describe the advances that you get from the SWAT mission and how it compares with what we've had historically with altimetry.
Yeah, SWAT is being expected for the past, I would say, 20 years. So it's a U.S.-French joint mission, as you said, was launched in December 22 and measures water surface elevations over both oceans and inland water. So it's the first satellite that was conceived to measure inland waters, because the previous altimeters, they targeted oceans. And then we found a way, like, you know, hydrologists, we found a way to use that data over inland waters. So it has this wide swath, totally 120 kilometers, resulting in this two-dimensional mapping of water elevations. So SWAT is fundamentally different from those traditional net zero altimeters, which measure only along a narrow ground track. So as a result, we have different products that they can be using different applications. So the first one is the Pixel Cloud, or PIC-C, which is a point cloud of individual water mask pixels, which is also available in vectors. They're gridded versions of water surface elevations at 100 and 250 meters. And there's when you go upscale, there's a vector product for rivers at 10 kilometer resolution, around 10 kilometers with 200 meter nodes. And that product gives you water surface elevation, river width, and slope over these reaches. And because we have all this data, water surface elevation, river width, and slope, this SWAT team called Discharge Algorithm Working Group, or DAG, they've been working for the past 10, 15 years on ways to estimate discharge from SWAT. And they finally came with the first version last year. And after a few improvements in their workflows, now they're reaching accuracies that match their expectations pre-launch. And we've been evaluating the accuracy of that discharge over South America. And what we found is that it generally does better than high map forced with GeoDAS runoff. So they're getting there. There's more evaluations to be done in terms of when and where SWAT discharge estimates are more accurate, so we can better use, for example, a data simulation framework.
And I mean, it's impossible to monitor the discharge of, for example, the Amazon or anything. So we really don't know what's truth, right?
Yeah, the truth is that we define the accuracy based on the limited number of gauges that we have. But it is true that that's where SWAT is unique. So now you have spatially distributed discharge estimates everywhere,
everywhere. And really, I think these large, very wide river reaches be impossible to monitor, it seems like, directly. So now SWAT helps with that. So now you can estimate the discharge and you can also estimate reservoir levels.
Yeah, that's another product. So there's another one of these products is this reservoir inlet water surface elevation that you can also get the water extent and the volume change of these reservoirs. And that's another unique capability of SWOT, because previous altimeters, if you're lucky enough, the satellite would pass over your favorite reservoir. But now SWOT covers most reservoirs globally. So now you have a way more comprehensive monitoring of surface waters, like including lakes, reservoirs, and rivers.
And those reservoirs, many of them are used for hydroelectricity. And so in the past, it's been impossible to get any information on hydroelectric generation and stuff and how they operate the reservoirs and everything. So now you can estimate these things with the data from SWOT.
Yeah, that's one work that we've been doing at NASA Goddard in the framework of our SWOT project, which is to implement a SWOT-based reservoir operation scheme in HIMAP. So once we have that, we can represent the impacts of reservoir operation in river systems across the globe.
And another area that is of interest, you know, so SWOT is, I think I was talking to Dennis Lettenmeyer recently, and he said he was happy that surface water was at the beginning of the acronym, surface water and ocean topography, so you get equal rights or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
But another area is in the coast, near the coast. So it was challenging in the past to estimate the bathymetry and sea level rise near the coast. And so now with SWOT, I think you have much better coverage in that zone.
Yeah, now there's another working group in the SWOT science team, which they're looking at the coast and estuaries. So now in SWOT, we have the continuum coast, estuary, and rivers. So you can see there's a recent study looking at the propagation of tides inland. So with SWOT, you can see that because of the two-dimensional feature that the satellite has. And we can also include that information in models, in hydrodynamic models, so we can constrain the model downstream with the sea level change and simulate the sea level rise impact. Once you have a longer time series from SWOT, because right now it's, 2.5 years, but once it gets a longer time series, we can have that simulation and quantify the impact of sea level rise, or even tides. There are other works that by groups in Germany, they're using SWOT to combine the natural tidal variability with SWOT, and they can get a SWOT-based tide. So we can use that data and ingest in models.
And since you also have estimates of freshwater discharge to the coast, you can estimate the impact of freshwater inflows into the ocean to evaluate its impact on circulation and things like that, I assume.
Yeah. When you're looking for topics on what to do with the global discharge product, that's one thing that I had suggested. There are past estimates of global contributions of inland water to oceans based on limited number of gauges or even models, but now we can do the same thing with SWOT.
You have global coverage because you've got this wide swath, 120 kilometers, and then the revisit time, I think, is about 21 days at the equator, but then it's much shorter as you go towards the poles because you've got increased coverage. Maybe you can describe that, you know, how frequently you would get data.
I would say that's a limitation in terms of a temporal monitoring. And so over the equator, as I said, you have a 21-day revisit. And when you get close to high latitudes, you have more often visits. And that's where you have combining SWOT with models. You find the optimal combination because the model play that it's kind of this dynamic interpolator between two observations. Yeah, so yeah, that gap could be filled with modeling frameworks.
And Augusto, you were involved a lot in doing modeling to support integration of SWOT data once it became available. Can you describe some of these models?
Yeah, so HIMAP was developed about 15 years ago. I was in my CNES, postdoc CNES, the French Space Agency, and that postdoc was in the framework of SWOT. So I was involved in SWOT in the early stages. The development of HIMAP had the goal of integrating SWOT. Yeah, but then I moved to NASA, and then all the priorities came up, and then I got detached somehow from SWOT, but now I'm back. So in the past 15, 20 years, there's been a lot of effort on integrating or finding ways to assimilate SWOT. So back then, people were using synthetic data. So they were generating what SWOT would look like and test in these synthetic cases how SWOT would contribute in improving discharge simulations. But now we have the actual data. So that's the next step. There are multiple modeling groups out there. I don't want to list all of them because I'm afraid to miss some. But we are very close to having a system. We actually gathered, we did this test with integrating, assimilating water surface elevation from SWOT into a HiMap. And we see that it improves discharge and water surface elevation in the Ohio basin. And the next step is to move to the CONUS scale and then globally. So the ultimate goal of our project is to demonstrate that SWOT data simulation can provide us with a better estimates of surface water dynamics.
And I see online that they mentioned that the SWOT emission has a nominal 3.5 year lifespan. But I mean, I know from GRACE satellites, they had a nominal lifespan, maybe of 5 years for the first mission, and it lasted 17. So do these nominal lifespans mean very much? And do you expect SWOT to last a lot longer than that?
Yeah, like all NASA satellites, they have this like short lifespan, but at the end, like a train, we live for, I don't know, 20 years, you mentioned GRACE, and then you have MODIS. So I think now the idea is to just think ahead of time and just assume that we'll live longer so we can use this data and maybe transfer them for operational systems to support decision-making. So let's not wait and see what happens like 10 years away and work now and expect that the satellite will live longer.
And, you know, if you do get it integrated into operations, then that really puts the pressure on to maintain the satellites and to have another mission and to keep the show on the road, right?
Yeah, that shows the relevance and the impact of the satellite. And that's what we do at NASA Goddard with LIS. We develop a lot of modeling systems for operations.
Yeah, that gets on to the next topic, you know, your integration of satellites or remote sensing and modeling. And you have been involved in many projects at NASA, PI or co-PI or co-investigator, looking at different aspects of land surface modeling. And you already described that a little bit with using for your global analysis of floods in 2025, you used global land data simulation runoff. And then you fed that into your HiMap model then to estimate discharge and flooding. You're also involved in the North American land data simulation system, and you're continually updating that. So can you describe the most recent, the NL-3 version, you know, what it can do now and what the advances are relative to previous versions?
Yes, NL-3 will be a big advancement compared to the previous version, NL-2. So NL-3 will have, I mean, we're working on that right now as we talk. So we have a 1 kilometer spatial resolution compared to the 12.5 kilometer spatial resolution from the previous version. And then NL-3 is a joint effort between NASA, Goddard, and Marshall Centers. And in addition to the 1 kilometer resolution, the domain now spans from Central America, including Caribbean, North America, Alaska, and Hawaii. So that's a big difference from the previous version. And the outputs of NL-3 are expected to be released daily with a 7-hour latency. So that's another big change compared to the previous version. We based on NOAA-NP land surface model, and they'll be ingesting this new meteorological data set that we developed exclusively for the system. And on top of all this, we'll be assimilating terrestrial water storage from GRACE, soil moss from SMAP, and the ESA CCI, the Climate Change Initiative, Lint Area Index from MODIS, and this machine learning-based product, Snow product, also based on MODIS. So we are constraining the model in multiple ways. And on top of that, there'll be HiMap providing surface water dynamics. And as a result, we'll be supporting water managers and flood preparedness. We've been closely engaging with over 150 professionals across 46 U.S. states. And our key stakeholders are NOAA, the National Integrated Drought Information System, and the National Drought Mitigation Center. So we are closely working with these people so we can address their needs. So that this is a system that is being designed based on end user needs.
But that's amazing. And it's great that you're using all these different types of satellite data to constrain the models and this data simulation, continually updating the model. So GLDES is global and NLDES is now expanded area and higher resolution. And then constraining with all of those data, SMAP for soil moisture, GRACE for total water storage, and SWAT and all of these things should really improve the reliability of the output. And then it's impressive that you're connecting with the stakeholders, you know, in so many different states to help with water resources management and flooding and all of these different things.
Yeah, this has been a new NASA priority in the past, I would say, year or two, that Earth Science to Action, which is like, well, when you develop something new by using satellites or modeling systems, that you focus on how that work will be improving U.S. taxpayers' lives and also like global populations' lives. So to show that development will have an actual impact.
Right. And then, I mean, there are a lot of countries that have limited monitoring or modeling capacities. And so for those regions, probably what you guys are providing is probably the only thing. And it also it provides a baseline for other things, for comparison and everything.
Yeah, so exactly.
Really valuable. Yeah,
in addition to NLDES 3, we are also developing this global system that is called NASA HydroGlobe, which has the same configuration of NLDES 3, but it's globally at 5 kilometers spatial resolution. And LIS is also the backbone of GLDES, which is at a coarse resolution, but it's the, I would say that's arguably the most popular data set that derived from models that we produce.
And so this 5 kilometer global, when do you expect that that would be released or when will that be?
So there was a first version, I think kilometers, that was, I'm not sure if it was released. It was developed 2 years ago. We are now working on an updated version, this one at 5 kilometer and including more DA capabilities. It should be sometime this year because, you know, running these models at 5 kilometer globally, it takes several months, especially with all these data simulation capabilities.
Yeah. And Augusto, you're from Brazil, and I really enjoy visiting Brazil many times. And I've been very impressed with the Brazilian government supporting students to study abroad. And you mentioned going to France and CNES for your PhD in southern France and working with the IRD group, the French group IRD, and I don't know how to pronounce, International Research Pool of Development or something like that.
Yeah.
and they are working globally also, and they are working in Brazil. So this is a really nice interchange, you know, and Brazilian students have a great opportunity to travel and see many different things. Maybe you can describe a little bit your experience working in your PhD in France and working, exchanging with Brazil and the Amazon and all of that sort of thing. You worked there.
Yeah, so that was back in 2006. So the Federal University of Rio had a collaboration with, as you mentioned, the IRD, the French Institute for Research for Development, or Instituto de Recherche pour le Développement. And so that's how I went to France to be part of my PhD, which ended up being most of my PhD. I spent 3 years there working on my thesis, and the topic was the use of radar altimeters to improve the hydrological modeling of the Amazon basin. So that's how I got familiar with modeling, with altimeters, and then that's how I did my network in France, and then I finished my PhD. And at that time, it was, as you mentioned, Brazil was investing a lot in science, like in sending students abroad. So I was lucky to be there at the right time. And of course that later on, we had other governments that almost defunded the science in the country. So after my PhD, I went to work at METEO France. I spent about 1 year there working on West Africa hydrology with Aaron Boone. And then after that, I started this CNES postdoc working on SWAT. So I spent a total of 5 years in France. That was a great experience, and I got exposed to different topics like Amazon hydrology, radar altimetry, West Africa hydrology, Yeah, that was great. A great experience.
And I know when I visited in the past for different projects, even people back in the 60s and 70s, they were going to the US, UC Davis. I remember the parent of a colleague saying he went to University College in California in Davis and from Brazil. So it's been going on for a long time, and it's just really amazing. I know you mentioned earlier, you know, flooding Rio every year, but also in southern Brazil in the last couple of years, and the importance of soil moisture there. But yeah, Brazil has also been experiencing extreme intense droughts in the last few years. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit, Augusto.
Yeah, since 2000, there's been three major water crises in the country. So it's becoming more often, which is interesting, because Brazil is the world's water richest country. Looking at like model outputs, like 20% of runoff generated globally is in Brazilian territory. We have 20% of renewable surface fresh water. But at the same time, there's all this water crisis going on. And some studies, they're demonstrating that these droughts, they are magnified by Amazon deforestation. When you have this feedback from the forest to the atmosphere, so it rains, then there's evapotranspiration that contributes to the atmospheric conditions. And there is also these processes called, popularly called flying rivers, that transfer moisture, atmospheric moisture from the Amazon to other parts of South America, including Brazil. So there's more and more studies demonstrating that process. But I think initially, like, that was only a theory, but now there are some demonstrations, empirical and model-based demonstrations, that this process actually happened. And that's a paradigm, because that deforestation is mostly led by agricultural expansion, cattle. And at the same time, it's impacting agriculture elsewhere in Brazil. So you're taking water from those other areas. And Brazil is the major producer of beef, of coffee beans, of soybeans, and other commodities. So if you have a water crisis in Brazil, that quickly becomes a world crisis. Like back in 2021, when you have that was the most recent water crisis, you paid more for your coffee because as a result of that crisis.
And you've been able to document this with the GRAY satellite data to see the extent of these droughts. And 2015 drought starting in 2012, driven by reduced rainfall 2012 to 2015. And then also linkages between the GRACE data and soil moisture and reservoir storage declines. And Brazil is also, its energy sources are strongly linked to water, because 70% of your electricity is derived from hydropower. So droughts impact many aspects of Brazilian lives, and increasing in intensity, it seems like.
Yeah, so because Brazil is so water rich, like surface water rich, I think that creating the culture that water is endless. So as a result, that has a deep impact socially, to the point that, as you said, hydropower generation is about 70% of source of electricity in Brazil. And this is because other renewable sources of energy have been developed, such as solar and wind, but still Brazil heavily relies on hydropower. So if you have a drought in that specific basin, that where you find most of the dams, that's the Paraná River basin, if there's a drought there, then the country collapses. And that's where also a lot of the agricultural production is found. And then the solution for that is, because Brazil relies so much on surface water in those aspects, so I should have a backup plan, such as using groundwater. But even though groundwater accounts for about 55% of the nation's water demand, but that's mostly driven by irrigation. But groundwater is also responsible for a significant portion of the country's small municipalities. About 40% of Brazilian municipalities rely on groundwater, but they are mostly small municipalities. The large ones still rely heavily on surface water, like São Paulo, that 2021 found itself almost no water. But at the same time, because Brazil should look for a backup plan in these cases, like when you have no more surface water in a specific region, you should go for groundwater. You don't have enough monitoring. So did you look at the monitoring network for groundwater in Brazil? They have about 400 or 500 wells, which is 40, 50,000 times less than what you have in the US. And Brazil is larger than the US without Alaska. So that you can see that it's a big gap in monitoring. And without monitoring, you don't know how to optimally use that water. No, you could have groundwater as a backup plan, but you cannot be in a situation where northwestern India is or Bangladesh is, where the groundwater is depleting. You have to be smart. You have to use groundwater in a wise way. But for that, you need data.
Yeah. And you mentioned Kaveh Madani in one of his recent reports on global water scarcity. And actually, he called it water bankruptcy, I think, and mentioning that surface water is like your checking account and groundwater, your savings account. And so important to develop them both. And I know when we had Davi Mello visiting here for a year, and he was looking at the drought in Sao Paulo in around 2012, 2014, area, the almost total reliance on the Cantareira reservoir system. And then that was dropping off a cliff. And but then there's a lot of groundwater being used. Ricardo Hirata says, you know, it's not permitted, so you don't know how much is being used, but suggesting that up to 25% of the water in Sao Paulo was coming from groundwater wells. But I think you had a really nice comment in Nature about the importance for Brazil to develop a drought plan. And I think that would be very valuable, because to understand and to monitor the system and to understand what the resources are and all of that sort of thing, very important part of planning for drought.
Yeah, I've been collaborating with the Brazilian Geological Service and the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro in the framework of a PhD thesis that was being developed by Clive Camacho. And the goal, and he works for the Brazilian Geological Service, and the goal was to use this limited number of groundwater gauges in a machine learning framework combined with a multiple satellite data, including, you know, MODIS, GRACE, iMERGE, and other geological information, to get the spatial and temporal distribution of groundwater variability across the country. So that's a first step. So he concluded his PhD last year. We have a paper in review describing the data set. And my hope is that this data set can be eventually transferred for operations by the Geological Service and being used as a guide and motivation for the federal government to install new wells to monitor groundwater.
That would be great. So it's marvelous that while working for NASA, you can also help your home country with flooding in Rio and drought and all of these things. So that's really cool.
Yeah, that goes in my overtime. That's a, I do that for fun.
Right. But it's nice to be able to give back to your home country too.
I do that because I have all these connections with Brazil, but I'm not limited to working with the Brazilians. Whoever is interested in collaborating, I'm always open.
We also release the scripts of these podcasts and also highlights and links to papers and stuff. So people are interested in more background information that's linked to this podcast. We provide it on the Water Resources Podcast website. So thank you so much, Augusto. Our guest today was Augusto Gaterana, research scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and in the Hydrological Sciences Lab. I really enjoyed the discussion, and it was nice to hear that your feeling is that flooding intensity is not increasing based on your analysis of 2025 in the last couple of decades, and describing these new satellite missions and how NASA is really trying to connect with stakeholders and get the science out to operations. So that's really cool.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you.